science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
Hello.
Hello.
Alan. Lisa.
He's actually coming to Auckland.
Who?
Dawkins. Next year.
Oh, the...
Yeah.
Really?
Yes, he is.
Okay, yeah. You have to explain about that.
He's being sponsored by AUT. I have to get that in.
Is he coming to do a talk?
Him and Lawrence Krauss. So, yeah, he's coming to give a public talk.
Going over my head.
Okay.
Sorry.
Lawrence Krauss is a physicist. He's sort of the American version of Dawkins, shall we say.
Okay.
So, yeah, that should be all good. Looking forward to that.
All right. Yeah. Well, I would like to say welcome back this week, and it is our final week, so we're gonna do a couple of stories that we have talked about. So we're gonna go through my guests a little bit quicker.
Oh yes, yep.
But we do have lots to talk about, and I would like to point out that we're having some wines in studio.
We are indeed
with Alan for the final day. So let's be classy and go through these stories. What's up first? A Soviet hero.
You caught me in mid-drink there. There we go.
Soviet hero is what I put down.
Yeah, so I sort of had a look at the stories that we'd talked about over the year, and just sort of picked out a few that really sort of struck me as being sort of interesting or unusual or whatever. And this was the first one. I mean, this is a guy that I had never heard of, and I guarantee most people had never heard of, a guy by the name of Stanislav Petrov. And he was a lieutenant colonel in the Soviet Air Defense Forces. And in 1983, he was basically sitting in front of his radar screen or whatever he was doing at the time, and he got a report that the Americans had launched some nuclear missiles towards Russia. And so, of course, this demanded an immediate response. So he was sort of in the chain of command, as it were, and it was his job to pass this message on to the higher-ups in Moscow, and they would decide whether to launch a nuclear strike or not. And he, with a bit of gut feeling or whatever, thank goodness, decided that this was sort of a computer malfunction or something like that, and he didn't pass this on. And it's just as well he didn't, because what had happened was that the Soviet satellites that were monitoring the States, they picked up a signal of the sun reflecting off the clouds over the States and picked that up as a false signal of a nuclear missile launch. And he himself said that the actual data that came through suggested maybe 1 to 5 missiles being launched, and he thought to himself, no, this is really dumb. They wouldn't just launch 1 to 5. It would be an all-out assault. So, and that was basically what he made his decision on. That was his gut feeling. And we're talking about this because he passed away this year, unfortunately. But what a hero. I mean, you know, he basically saved the world from...
That, I mean, it's incredible.
Yes.
You've got whatever it is, machines and data telling you that you should be making this decision to retaliate.
Yep.
And he ultimately decided, specifically because he noticed that it was an irregular...
Yeah. Well, it didn't make sense.
And he decided against it. Yeah. And it wasn't. And, well, okay, so this means there was some faulty equipment, doesn't it?
Yeah, basically, yes. And I think that the whole system at the time was relatively new, and so it was sort of, you know, being bedded in or teething or whatever. And fortunately, he had the presence of mind to not pass this on. And he was sort of saying that he wasn't sort of regular army or something like that, and if somebody else had been in that place, you know, who was accustomed to sort of following orders and saying yes, then things might have been very, very different. So
what was his background, do you know?
He'd basically been in that role the whole time. So he sort of started off, I think he trained as a pilot, I think, and then he went into air defence. But for some reason, he wasn't regular military or something like that. There was some sort of difference between him and just the, sort of the regular
and this,
folks. So.
This would have looked a little bit embarrassing for who?
Well, it didn't look a little bit embarrassing until it was made public in 1996, after the fall of the Soviet Union. So, of course...
So it wasn't actually known for a while.
No. Well, it would have been known by the high-ups there.
Yeah.
But obviously, you know, the way that the Soviet Union was run, nobody knew anything. And it only came out in the memoirs of one of the high-ups in the Soviet Defence Forces when that was written after the fall of the Soviet Union. It was around about 96, 97 or something. And, you know, he got quite a few awards around the world for for basically saving the world. As I say, his name, you know... It's not well known. It should be better known.
Yeah, why isn't this more of a big deal?
It really should be. I mean, you know, there's a contender for a Nobel Peace Prize. Sadly, he's gone now, so he won't be getting one of those. But, you know,
Because I guess this is making a case kind of against, not really against machines, but, you know, to keep having people who can listen to their gut
automated decisions.
Yes,
yeah.
Indeed. Yes, yep, no, totally agree. Totally agree.
Very interesting point, Lisa.
For once.
All right. Next topic.
Okay, so...
Whiskey,
indeed. Now, this was a really nice story because... we did this the week before Shamina's last show, and as a result of this story, one of the whiskey manufacturers from around Auckland rang up and said, hey, why don't we bring in some whiskeys, do the taste test and everything live on air? And so I was fully in agreement with that, and it coincided with Shamina's last show, so it was really nice. And very interesting story, because there's always the question with whiskey is, do you water or do you not water? So do you drink it straight or do you water it down? So some folk in, I'm pretty sure it was Sweden, yeah, some Swedish chemists decided to model what was going on in whiskey. So obviously taste is quite a subjective thing, and so they resorted to, dare I say it, computers, and they did a computer modelling of whiskey. Now, whiskey is predominantly water and alcohol and a whole lot of flavour compounds. And what they did was to choose one of these flavour compounds called guaiacol. And they did a computer simulation of what would happen if you mixed the ethanol, the water, and the guaiacol in different amounts. Whereabouts in the whole volume of the whiskey do they sit? And what they found was when the whiskey concentration, when the alcohol concentration was about 40-50%, which is roughly what whiskey is, then all of the ethanol molecules, which is the alcohol, they all prefer to be at the interface, in other words, at the top of the whiskey, so basically next door to the air, let's say. Okay, so you get a glass of whiskey, all of
you'd
the
taste that first.
Sort of. All of the ethanol molecules want to be on the top because they've got little bits on them that are oily. Okay, you know, oil and water don't mix.
Yeah.
Okay, so an ethanol molecule is made of a bit that really, really likes water and a bit that really doesn't like water. Okay. And so this is a sort of a tail. And so the ethanol molecules cluster on the surface with their tails in the air because they don't want to be in the water. But if the concentration's too high, some of them have to be in the water. And this guaiacol stuff as well really wants to be with the ethanol molecules rather than with the water molecules, okay? And so what happens if you add water, and the guaiacol is where you get the taste from. So if you add the water, the guaiacol then comes up to the top to be with the ethanol, because now there's space at the top.
Right.
Okay. And so these guys are recommending an optimal concentration of alcohol around about 27%. So if you roughly half water your whiskey down, it'll taste better and it'll smell better simply because you've got more of the odor compounds right at the top of the whiskey. Right. That's the theory. And I've got to say, when we did the taste test on air, it really... It made a heck of a difference, I'd say.
That is very interesting, because I always feel, and this might just be a New Zealand cultural thing, but you feel, you know, not as much of a whiskey connoisseur perhaps if you have water with your whiskey. Do you understand what I mean?
It's a bit of alcohol snobbishness.
You're kind of cheating if you get some water with your...
Yep. No, I agree.
Actually, that's not true. And
well, as I say, this was all done on a computer. So this is what the computer's saying. This is where the molecules are going to be, and if that's the case, then you should get a better smell and a better taste simply because it's close to the top. So,
We tested it on air, BFM. So I think that's what it is.
you get a better taste, but it's still watered down. Like, I mean, the volume of alcohol is watered down a bit.
Yes.
But you get the better taste of alcohol.
But you get a better taste of not just the alcohol, but the flavour.
Yeah.
That's the flavour compounds that are all
best
important.
That means you could extend your drinking because you could have another glass.
Absolutely, yes.
But that would be the same amount of one glass without water.
It would.
Giving great advice.
Longer nights, great.
There's the Christmas advice, folks. There we go. Yeah.
So story number three, we have ethics. In drug trials.
This really wasn't a drug trial. This was an undergraduate experiment at the University of Northumbria in England. And this actually occurred in 2015, but it only came to light this year when when the whole thing went to court and the university got fined £400,000 because So there's some sports science students doing an undergraduate experiment on the effect that caffeine has on your sports performance.
Oh.
Okay. So the experiment was supposedly that the kids would get 300 milligrams of caffeine, which is equivalent to around about three cups of coffee, in an orange juice, chug that down, and then see how that affects your performance. Okay. Now, instead of being given 300 milligrams, two students were given 30 grams of, yeah.
That's a lot.
30 grams of caffeine.
Wow. Now, how were they getting it?
So it's just in an orange juice. No, oh, they just drink it, okay?
Okay.
The lethal dose of caffeine has been sort of estimated to be around about 12 to 18 grams.
Oh, okay? My gosh.
So these guys got 30 grams of the stuff. And they had to go to hospital for quite a long time. Both of them lost about 10 kg. Supposedly, they suffered no ill effects, but who would know in the long term?
What?
And this is due to just massive, massive incompetence on somebody's behalf that doesn't recognize the difference between 300 milligrams and 30 grams, which, in my experience, is an absolute buttload, you know.
Isn't it 0.3 grams?
Yeah, 0.3 grams is exactly right. So this is the equivalent of 300 cups of coffee all at once.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, 300 cups of coffee all at once. And quite rightly, as I say, the university got taken to court by the health and safety folks and everything, fined £400,000 for this. And whoever was in charge of that experiment shouldn't be let anywhere near undergraduates ever again. I mean, God's sake. It was just utterly appalling. Yeah. Utterly appalling.
I'm going to take from this that you can drink too much coffee.
Yeah.
There is a limit.
Well, it's the speed at which you drink it, I guess. That's the thing. But,
and
you know,
also,
30 grams all at once.
Don't conduct experiments.
No.
We don't know what we're doing.
No.
Final story.
Mm-hmm.
That is a neuron star collision.
A neutron star.
Oh, it was just my autocorrect on the computer. That's what it was. Definitely know the difference between these two.
I like that. So this is probably the story of the year, I think, the most important scientific story of the year, where a couple of neutron stars were busy rotating around each other, and then they basically collided, and they gave out gravitational waves and a whole lot of radiation, and really, really importantly, some gold and some platinum. And this is really, really important because there's been a big question as to how the heavier elements in the universe and the periodic table have been formed, okay? We know how the light ones are formed. They're formed in stars, okay, in the interior of stars. But the heavy ones, how do we get the heavy ones? Because you need an awful lot of energy to make a heavy element. You've got to hold that nucleus together, and it's really, really difficult. And so this is the first confirmation that heavy elements can be made by these collisions of neutron stars. And neutron stars are collapsed stars like our sun that go from being utterly enormous to going to about sort of 20 kilometers across with the same mass. And so their density is just ridiculous. And these two stars have been orbiting each other at quite a rate of knots, but then they started going at around about 2,000 times per second. That's a lot.
Yeah.
That's very fast.
These extraordinarily massive things, 2,000 times per second, and then they annihilated each other, and what they think is that they've formed a black hole. And this was observed on Earth in the gravitational wave detector. So gravitational waves have only been sort of a thing for the past couple of years. They've only been known to exist for the past couple of years. And what they then managed to do was to, once the gravitational waves came through, all the astronomers on the planet pointed their telescopes at a particular part of the sky, and they actually saw this thing. Well, they didn't see the collision, but they saw the remnants of it.
Wow.
Yeah. And so this was seriously impressive, and you know, they could do all the spectral analysis and stuff and find what was given out in this, and the fact that you've got the heavy elements given out in this, you know, it's great.
Amazing.
It's, yeah.
Is this? But you're saying that, I mean, this probably has happened before, or a number of times before, but it's the first time that we were able to witness
to actually witness the production of heavy elements in the universe. And as somebody said on one of the websites, you know, the gold ring that you've got on your finger, the atoms in that were probably made in a neutron star collision, you know, millions and billions of years ago, sort of thing. So, you know.
Yeah.
It's very, very cool.
Very cool.
Okay.
We are finishing on a few people that have passed away around this time of the year.
Indeed. So
in the past.
Yeah, so Stanislav Petrov, obviously, he passed away this year. Some notable names. So Masaya Nakamura, who is a Japanese guy who actually invented Pac-Man in 1980. So he started off by having wooden horses for the kiddies to ride on the roof of a department store, and then he went to little model cars and stuff like that. Then he got into video games, and he invented Pac-Man. So he's got lasting fame, and that's where Namco came from, from his name. Who else? Peter Mansfield. So he got the Nobel Prize for the production of, or for the inventing MRI, magnetic resonance imaging.
Very useful.
Important.
Miriam Mirzakhani, who was the first female winner of the Fields Medal. And the Fields Medal is the Nobel.
Mathematics?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It's the sort of the Nobel Prize of mathematics sort of thing. And the question that's always asked is why was there no Nobel Prize in mathematics? And this may be true, this may be not, but apparently the story goes that Nobel's wife had an affair with a mathematician. Apparently, rumour has it.
So no mixing.
But yeah, she died tragically young, age 40. So yeah, that's very, very sad. And another guy, again, someone I didn't know about, Herbert Needleman, this guy. And this seems blindingly obvious to us now in hindsight, but it was in the 1970s that he was doing studies on children and their IQ, and he was the first person to show that lead had a bad effect on kids' IQ. Remember back in the days when you had leaded petrol and you had red lead paint? And well, you guys probably
don't remember
you're too
that.
Young.
Yeah, but my science teacher she was my chem teacher at high school. Mm-hmm. She began the year by telling us her parents poisoned her. And then she explained it was lead. She lived in the house there. So we were a bit like, oh, okay.
So, yeah, it's, as I say, it does seem blindingly obvious in hindsight, but, and it took till the 1970s, and they've been putting lead in petrol since around about the 1920s. So, could I just finish on two things?
Absolutely.
First of all, I went to see Paul McCartney on Saturday.
Sorry, that's some weird news. How was it?
Oh, it was beyond all expectation. Absolutely, absolutely magnificent.
Very good.
And the second thing, the best CD I've bought all year.
Yes.
There we go. So
look at this, Alan mixing up you. Yeah, I like it.
It wasn't actually released this year. It was released a couple of years ago, but it's a guy by the name of Lone Wolf.
Ah, yes.
Whose name is Paul Marshall. And
okay. I feel like I've heard of Lone Wolf.
Yeah, it's fantastic. It's bleak. It's minimalist. It's really sparse. If you like that sort of stuff, check it out because it's absolutely, absolutely magnificent.
I feel like
we might actually have some of that. We could see if we could play it later in the show.
I think Alan should get a graveyard shift.
You want to come play some music?
I did that on Radio 1 back in the day down on Otago. Oh. So, yeah.
There you go. So. Well, thank you, Alan, for this smashing year. And I look forward to next year. I do want to actually have a full show of Dear Science 1 week. So we might see if we can get that a go.
Okay, right.
Maybe get different producers and people
yeah
here.
Come
people
in and know what they're talking about.
No, it's been a pleasure. It really has.
You would like to stick around and finish your wine? We'll hear this from Tracy Martin next, so thank you.
Okay,
that was Dear Science.